There were long stretches of calm, when she was able to face her problem with the dispassionate clarity of weighing a problem in engineering. But she could find no answer. She knew that her desperate longing for the railroad would vanish, were she to convince herself that it was impossible or improper. But the longing came from the certainty that the truth and the right were hers, that the enemy was the irrational and the unreal, that she could not set herself another goal or summon the love to achieve it, while her rightful achievement had been lost, not to some superior power, but to a loathsome evil that conquered by means of impotence. She could renounce the railroad, she thought. She could find contentment here in this forest. But she would build the path, then reach the road below, then rebuild the road, and then she would reach the storekeeper of Woodstock, and that would be the end. And the empty white face, staring at the universe in stagnant apathy, would be the limit placed on her effort. Why? She heard herself screaming aloud. There was no answer. Then stay here until you answer it, she thought. You have no place to go, you can't move, you can't start grading a right-of-way until you know enough to choose a terminal. There were long, silent evenings when the emotion that made her sit still and look at the unattainable distance beyond the fading light to the south was loneliness for Hank Reardon. She wanted the sight of his unyielding face, the confident face looking at her with the hint of a smile. But she knew that she could not see him until her battle was won. His smile had to be deserved. It was intended for an adversary who traded her strength against his, not for a pain-beaten wretch who would seek relief in that smile and thus destroy its meaning. He could help her to live. He could not help her to decide for what purpose she wished to go on living. She had felt a faint touch of anxiety since the morning when she marked May 15th on her calendar. She had forced herself to listen to news broadcasts once in a while. She had heard no mention of his name. Her fear for him was her last link to the city. It kept drawing her eyes to the horizon at the south and down the road at the foot of the hill. She found herself waiting for him to come. She found herself listening for the sound of a motor. But the only sound to give her a futile start of hope at times was the sudden crackle of some large bird's wings hurtling through the branches into the sky. There was another link to the past that still remained as an unsolved question. Quentin Daniels and the motor that he was trying to rebuild. By June 1st, she would owe him his monthly check. Should she tell him that she had quit, that she would never need that motor and neither would the world? Should she tell him to stop and to let the remnant of the motor vanish in rust on some such junk pile as the one where she had found it? She could not force herself to do it. It seemed harder than leaving the railroad. That motor, she thought, was not a link to the past. It was her last link to the future. To kill it seemed like an act, not of murder, but of suicide. Her order to stop it would be her signature under the certainty that there was no terminal for her to seek ahead. But it is not true, she thought, as she stood at the door of her cabin on this morning of May 28th. It is not true that there is no place in the future for a superlative achievement of man's mind. It can never be true. No matter what her problem, this would always remain to her, this immovable conviction that evil was unnatural and temporary. She felt it more clearly than ever this morning, the certainty that the ugliness of the men in the city and the ugliness of her suffering were transient accidents, while the smiling sense of hope within her at the sight of a sun-flooded forest, the sense of an unlimited promise, was the permanent and the real. She stood at the door smoking a cigarette. In the room behind her, the sounds of a symphony of her grandfather's time were coming from the radio. She barely listened. She was conscious only of the flow of chords that seemed to play an underscoring harmony for the flow of the smoke curving slowly from her cigarette, for the curving motion of her arm moving the cigarette to her lips once in a while. She closed her eyes and stood still, feeling the rays of the sun on her body. This was the achievement, she thought. To enjoy this moment, to let no memory of pain blunt her capacity to feel as she felt right now. So long as she could preserve this feeling, she would have the fuel to go on. She was barely aware of a faint noise that came through the music, like the scratching of an old record. The first thing to reach her consciousness was the sudden jerk of her own hand flinging the cigarette aside. It came in the same instant as the realization that the noise was growing louder and that it was the sound of a motor. Then she knew that she had not admitted to herself how much she had wanted to hear that sound, how desperately she had waited for Hank Reardon. She heard her own chuckle. It was humbly, cautiously low, as if not to disturb the drone of revolving metal, which was now the unmistakable sound of a car rising up the mountain road. She could not see the road. The small stretch under the arch of branches at the foot of the hill was her only view of it. But she watched the car's ascent by the growing imperious strain of the motor against the grades and the screech of the tires on curves. The car stopped under the arch of branches. She did not recognize it. It was not the Black Hammond, but a long gray convertible. She saw the driver step out. It was a man whose presence here could not be possible. It was Francisco D'Anconia. The shock she felt was not disappointment. It was more like the sensation that disappointment would now be irrelevant. It was eagerness and an odd, solemn stillness, the sudden certainty that she was facing the approach of something unknown and of the gravest importance. The swiftness of Francisco's movements was carrying him toward the hill while he was raising his head to glance up. He saw her above at the door of the cabin and stopped. She could not distinguish the expression on his face. He stood still for a long moment, his face raised to her. Then he started up the hill. She felt, almost as if she had expected it, that this was a scene from their childhood. He was coming toward her, not running, but moving upward with a kind of triumphant, confident eagerness. No, she thought. This was not their childhood. It was the future as she would have seen it then, in the days when she waited for him as for her release from prison. It was a moment's view of a morning they would have reached if her vision of life had been fulfilled, if they had both gone the way she had then been so certain of going. Held motionless by wonder, she stood looking at him, taking this moment, not in the name of the present, but as a salute to their past. When he was close enough and she could distinguish his face, she saw the look of that luminous gaiety which transcends the solemn by proclaiming the great innocence of a man who has earned the right to be light-hearted. He was smiling and whistling some piece of music that seemed to flow like the long, smooth, rising flight of his steps. The melody seemed distantly familiar to her. She felt that it belonged with this moment. Yet she felt also that there was something odd about it, something important to grasp, only she could not think of it now. Hi, Slug. Hi, Frisco. She knew by the way he looked at her, by an instant's drop of his eyelids closing his eyes, by the brief pull of his head striving to lean back and resist, by the faint, half-smiling, half-helpless relaxation of his lips, by the sudden harshness of his arms as he seized her, that it was involuntary, that he had not intended it, and that it was irresistibly right for both of them. The desperate violence of the way he held her, the hurting presence of his mouth on hers, the exultant surrender of his body to the touch of hers, were not the form of a moment's pleasure. She knew that no physical hunger could bring a man to this. She knew that it was the statement she had never heard from him, the greatest confession of love a man could make. No matter what he had done to wreck his life, this was still the Francisco D'Anconia in whose bed she had been so proud of belonging. No matter what betrayals she had met from the world, her vision of life had been true, and some indestructible part of it had remained within him. And in answer to it, her body responded to his. Her arms and mouth held him, confessing her desire, confessing an acknowledgment she had always given him, and always would. Then the rest of his years came back to her with a stab of the pain of knowing that the greater his person, the more terrible his guilt in destroying it. She pulled herself away from him. She shook her head. She said in answer to both of them, "No." He stood looking at her, disarmed and smiling. "Not yet. You have a great deal to forgive me first. But I can tell you everything now.